ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय.
Today from Srimad Bhagavad Gita, chapter 12, text number 8. Chapter is entitled Devotional Service.
Mayi eva mana adhatsva. Mayi buddhim niveshaya. Nivasishyasi mayeva. Ata urdhvam na samshayaha.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, E.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Just fix your mind upon me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and engage all your intelligence in me. Thus you will live in me always without a doubt. Purport. One who is engaged in Lord Krishna's devotional service lives in a direct relationship with the Supreme Lord, so there is no doubt that his position is transcendental from the very beginning. A devotee does not live on the material plane. He lives in Krishna. The holy name of the Lord and the Lord are non-different. Therefore, when a devotee chants Hare Krishna, Krishna and his internal potency are dancing on the tongue of the devotee. When he offers Krishna food, Krishna directly accepts these eatables, and the devotee becomes Krishna-ized by eating the remnants. One who does not engage in such service cannot understand how this is so, although this is a process recommended in the Bhagavad Gita and in other Vedic literatures. Hare Krishna. Welcome to one and all. Thank you for coming to tonight's class. We'll repeat the translation again quickly. Just fix your mind upon me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and engage all your intelligence in me. Thus you will live in me always, without a doubt. So, 12th chapter begins with Arjuna's inquiry to Krishna about what is the best method of worship. He wants to know, is it personal or impersonal? Should we meditate on the form, two-handed Krishna, as we see on our altar here, or should we worship the unmanifest, all-pervading consciousness, the impersonal Brahman? And so at this point in the chapter, Krishna has definitively answered these questions by stating emphatically that without any doubt, Arjuna, fix your mind on me in my personal two-armed Shyamasundar form. And in this way, you will live in me always. He's saying this process is the superior form. The impersonal method is fraught with distress and is very difficult for one who is embodied. And Krishna has demonstrated this because the 11th chapter ended with the revelation of Krishna's two-armed form as being the source of all emanations. After witnessing the universal form, finally, Arjuna requested Krishna to restore himself first to his four-armed Vishnu form and then to his two-armed Krishna form. So without a doubt, Krishna's form is the topmost. Now at this point, what Krishna is establishing here is the method of worship. Now that we know that Krishna is the supreme, what is the superior method by which we can please the Lord and perfect our lives? So the interesting point is that one must fix one's mind and intelligence in the Lord at all times. And this is the topmost instruction. If we have to boil down the ultimate purpose or the supreme goal of Bhagavad Gita in one shloka, this shloka would very much fit the bill. Because Krishna is saying, adhatsva, niveshaya. These two words are in the imperative form. That means Krishna is giving his order. He's giving his mandate that this is the topmost instruction because this 12th chapter is entitled Devotional Service and it comes within the middle six bhakti chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. So therefore, this is his topmost instruction and the essence of the whole Gita is right here is to fix one's internal senses, the mind and intelligence on the Lord. And Prabhupada in his purport is explaining how to do this by chanting the holy names. So simply by chanting the holy names of the Lord, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram, Hare Hare, one can live within Krishna at all times. So it sounds like a very simple instruction, a little deceivingly simple. One tends to think that spiritual life must be very complicated or must be some kind of ritual. How can it just be boiled down to just chanting this mantra? But the answer is that it's not so easy to just chant this mantra, is it? All of us as practicing sadhakas, we chant maybe 2 hours a day, our 16-round quota. But what are we doing the other 22 hours of the day? How is our mind and intelligence fixed on the Lord at that time? And even within our 16 rounds, are we chanting our rounds with mind, all our intelligence, and our mind completely fixed on the Lord? Or is the mind wandering? Is the intelligence going to so many other topics? One easy way to determine this is, how much are we victimized by the force of ignorance, by sleep when we chant japa? The interesting thing is, how many people have ever fallen asleep while eating a good meal, just all of a sudden passing out in the middle? Does it ever happen? Why? Because there's taste for prasad. There's taste for food. It's something we've developed a long, hard habit for billions of births. Even as cats, as dogs, as donkeys, even as plants, we're eating food. And so it's a very easy activity for us because there's interest. There's real taste. Similarly, when you're talking with a good friend after a long time, do you just have a conversation and just pass out in the middle and say, oh, sorry, wake me up when I fall asleep? It doesn't happen because there's some interest in conversing with a friend. But as Prabhupada's making the point in this purport, the holy name of the Lord and the Lord are non-different. So actually when we sit down to chant our rounds, Krishna's there. Where is he? Dancing on our tongue. Our friend is right there with us. So why are we falling asleep? It's not a very courteous way to treat a guest. If someone comes to your home and you're just sitting there and he knocks on the door, do you just say, oh, hey, come on in. Go grab something from the kitchen if you're hungry. I'm busy watching TV. How hospitable, how nice would that be to the guest who's coming? So when we don't pay attention in our japa, it's the same thing. It's like someone coming to your home and you just turn your back on him and stare at the wall and ignore him. So what is the reason why we have such inability to fix our mind on Krishna and engage our intelligence in Krishna? And the reason is because our priorities are mixed up. Even though the holy name is the supreme benediction for this age of Kali Yuga, it's the ultimate goal, the ultimate necessity, still, we have attraction for so many other things. Like, for example, we have the merciful form of the Lord in the temple, but when we take darshan, sometimes we get distracted by the other transcendental forms on the right or the left side of the temple, depending on which gender you belong to. Because there's habit, there's practice at looking at the opposite sex, but we don't have so much practice at looking at the deity form of the Lord with attachment, with real love. So this is what is coming out in Gita at this point, is that Krishna is saying, don't worry. You're not on the transcendental platform yet. That's okay. That's why I'm speaking these instructions. It's meant for you. All of you who don't have love for me yet, no problem. I'm giving you the process by which you can develop this love. So one may ask, well, if we really love Krishna, then why do we have to work so hard for it? If you really love someone, do you need to follow all these rules and regulations? You just pick up a magazine, go to a movie, and there's so much more attraction for whatever forms are there. But the reason is because we're covered over. Because we have so much dirt covering the mirror of our pure self that we actually, our spontaneous love for the Lord is completely engrossed in the modes of material nature. So Krishna is giving the process by which we can clean up this mirror of the heart. So in text 8, we don't quite have the qualification for this. Like, maybe my apologies to all the Paramahamsas in the room and the descended acharyas. But for those sadhakas like my own unfortunate self, we have to turn to the next verse to find out, okay, Krishna says, if you can't fix your mind on me without deviation, then follow what? Abhyasena yogina tato. Then follow these regulative principles. The next verse he says, if you can't follow the regulative principles, then you work for me. You engage in my duties like that. So what we see is a very nice progression in which everybody in the world, no matter who they are, can connect with Krishna, whether they're very advanced or they're neophyte, whether they're from India, from very pious families, or whether from the West in very degraded families. It doesn't really matter because Krishna's got something for everyone. Anybody can connect to the instructions and move forward from his present position. So the way to analyze these verses of Gita, especially these four, 12.8 to 12.11, is that there are different levels of consciousness and different levels of advancement in devotion, and these can be summarized as three. The first is Bhagavat Marg, or Bhagavat Vidhi. The second is called Pancharatrik Vidhi. And the third is called the Vedic path, or Vedic Vidhi. So Bhagavat is the purely transcendental platform. This is for one who does not identify with his body. What are his activities in devotional service? And that's coming out in this verse, 12.8. His activities are simply hearing, simply chanting. This means 24-hour practically engagement in devotional service. We have the story of Haridas Thakur, and he was chanting over 192 rounds a day. He wasn't engaged in so much nonsense or so many other auxiliary activities. He could focus his mind perfectly. We have the example of Gorkishor Das Babaji, who lived on the bank of the Ganga underneath a boat, and when he was hungry, he would eat mud. We have example of Jagannath Das Babaji, for example. And what was his external activities? Even though he was taking prasad one day and a dog came to eat off his plate and a servant removed the plate and said, oh, now the plate has been contaminated. But Jagannath Das Babaji didn't make anything of it. He just kept eating. And the next day, his servant brought him prasad to eat and he refused to eat. And the servant asked him, oh, have I offended you with my service? And Jagannath Das Babaji replied, no, you haven't offended me. I'm just wondering where are our guests today? The dog that was here yesterday. I'm not going to start eating until he comes. And so this was his mood, is that even though there's a dog eating off his plate, what does he care? He's off the modes of material nature. He's completely transcendental. So therefore, no rules and regulations really apply to him. We have the example of the gopis, for example. What is the consciousness of the gopis? There is a story that one day, Srimati Radharani, as she's making her cow dung patties, in order to dry them in the sun, so she can then cook on these patties in order to make nice sweets for Krishna. Because in the afternoon, she cooks nice rasgulla and sandesh and all these sweets. But the problem is, while she's making these cow dung patties, she's being overcome by all these feelings of ecstasy. Her body becomes completely stunned in remembrance of Krishna. Just the thought of Krishna's flute, his eyes, his face, that glance that Krishna gave her, maybe many days ago. Still, that one tiny experience is sufficient to render Radharani completely incapable of rendering her service. She's completely useless as far as practical activity goes. Krishna's forcing his way into her mind at all times. So she then prays to the Lord. She says, please get this Krishna out of my head. He's actually interfering with my service. I want to just get him out of here so I can focus on my seva nicely, and then I can please him. So whereas we find all the yogis in this material world are struggling to fix their mind at the lotus feet of Krishna, to concentrate their minds very earnestly on one point, on the supreme goal of Krishna, what is Radharani? She's praying for the opposite. She doesn't want any of this concentration anymore. She wants to forget about Krishna. So this is her consciousness. She is fixed in mind, and her intelligence is always focused on how to serve the Lord. So this is the Bhagavat principle. This is one who needs follow no regulations and is off the bodily concept of life. The unfortunate circumstance is most of us aren't there yet. Therefore, the next step down is if you don't have this spontaneous love or attachment for Krishna, then what do you do? And what does Krishna say? He says, look, you identify with your body. You're not transcendental yet. Therefore, you purify your senses. Your body is composed of eyes, ears, tongue, nose, mouth. And these are attached to so many sense objects in this world. So, engage those senses in Krishna, and then those material senses are no longer material. They become Krishnaized. And this is what Prabhupada's saying in this purport, is the process of Krishnaization. So in 12.9, Krishna is saying, if you can't think of me always, Jai Shishi Radha Gopinath Lalita Vishaka Devi Ki Jai. Krishna is explaining that it's no big deal if you don't have spontaneous attachment for my form. Instead, you perform what's called the Pancharatrik process. When Lord Brahma had all the Vedas that were spoken to him, when he forgot them, by the Madhu demon and the Kaitabha demons, they actually stole the Vedic knowledge from Brahma's memory. And Lord Brahma went to pray to Lord Vishnu, and he came in his form of the Madhusudan demon to kill those demons to recover the Vedic knowledge. And at this point, Lord Brahma, he asked the Lord to instruct him again. He says, now that I've forgotten all this Vedic knowledge, it's been stolen from me, please give it to me again. But because I'm not guaranteed that I'll live long enough to hear all this knowledge again, and I don't even know if I can remember everything, just summarize it. The Vedas normally are, you know, lakhs and lakhs of verses, but you just explain it to me in 5 nights. Give me the essence. And so that's why it's called Pancharatra, because in 5 nights, Lord Krishna explained the essence of all the Vedas to Lord Brahma. And what does the essence mean? Is that rather than all these rituals meant for gradual elevation from the deepest levels of ignorance all the way to the transcendental level, what Krishna is giving is regulations meant for those fixed in the mode of goodness, for those who want to directly connect their activities to the Lord. He gave some rules and regulations. There's no concessions for meat eating, no concessions for intoxication or those things that are given in the rest of the Vedas, no karmakandi rituals. Everything is meant simply for pleasing the Lord. And what kind of form did this Pancharatra take? It takes the form of deity worship primarily. And so that means that because we can't meditate on the Lord's form within the core of our heart, because our hearts are so dirty, then we meditate on the form of the Lord, which he's mercifully assumed in stone or in wood or in any sort of material, but he enters that material and gives us the opportunity to worship this form. So it's Krishna's mercy that he's appearing in that form for our sake, so we can follow the Pancharatrik rules, and all our activities in devotional service can center around the deity. So therefore, what Prabhupada's explaining is, what is the lifestyle? Because maybe we can't sit on the bank of the Jamuna or sit on the bank of the Ganga and just chant all day. So what is the lifestyle of the next notch down look like? And it looks like this. One rises early in the morning to take bath, enters the temple and offers prayers, chants Hare Krishna, collects flowers to offer the deity, cooks foodstuffs to offer the deity, take prasadam, and so on. So all these activities directly connected to the Lord. This means it's more or less the temple lifestyle. One who is living a brahminical life, he always wakes early in the morning. Why? Because this will avoid sinful activity. Naturally, most sinful activities take place at night. How many nightclubs open up at 3 a.m. in the morning? How many parties have you ever been invited to at, 2:30 a.m.? Nobody parties at night. Nobody gets intoxicated in the early morning. These are only activities in the nighttime. So therefore, to regulate one's life, a very simple and easy thing to do is just go to bed early, wake up early, like that. And then you're bringing your life in line with Krishna's instructions. This is what he wants out of all of us. How to purify your body is, first of all, you wake up and you take bath. So this taking bath thing, it may be pretty intuitive to most people from cultured backgrounds, but I can assure you, where I'm from, taking bath in the morning is not common practice or not widely accepted, especially among kids or among various people and students. I mean, I remember in my college, it's one guy told me that he had this new theory. Someone told him that bathing is actually bad for, your hair and your skin. Therefore, he only took a bath every 2 weeks or something. Some people, because they have like dreadlocks, it's the style of hair which is matted. They can't really wash their hair, so they just forego the whole bathing ritual altogether. And so it's not common knowledge. But the reason why we do it, first of all, on the Bhagavat level, it's pleasing to Krishna. So it's actually giving him pleasure to see his devotee come to the temple fresh and clean. But if one's not convinced by this, so who cares about pleasing the Lord? It's just a stone. Let's say you're an atheist. Taking bath in the morning is still good. Why? Because cold water bath, especially first thing in the morning, what it does is it kills all the bacteria and the dirt, and it actually doesn't allow any germs to fester and cause any kind of infections. If you take hot water bath, which is what most people tend to do, then it actually leaves ground for all kinds of smells and odors and all kinds of germs to manifest. So what Krishna is giving is good from the spiritual level, good from the material. And it's also explained in the Ayurveda that taking early morning cold water bath actually makes one's skin glow and makes one more attractive to the opposite sex. So whether you're into pleasing Krishna, pleasing the opposite sex, having good health, it doesn't matter. Because this one instruction is actually applicable to everyone because it's the best way to live in the material world. Pancharatrik lifestyle is good for everyone. You want to succeed in business. What time does Donald Trump and Bill Gates wake up at? Guaranteed, they all wake up early in the morning. They all do all their most important, most intellectual activities during Brahma Muhurta time because that's when the mind is most focused. So the point is that one should follow the Pancharatrik lifestyle. This is lifestyle in the mode of goodness. This is actually what's being advocated by the Lord in the scriptures. And furthermore, we've only started. These are the first two instructions, rising early and taking bath. What to speak of, entering the temple, offering prayers, you know, offering obeisances to one's guru. By following Pancharatra, then everything becomes connected to the Lord and everything becomes purified. So one very quickly and rapidly advances to that transcendental stage. So when Prabhupada first came to the West, what was his original intention? He actually declares that his desire was to make brahmanas in the West, find a few qualified young people and instruct them in the scriptures, ideally bring them back to India, get them nicely trained up, and turn them into preachers. And his original instruction, as far as chanting went, to Hayagriva, Prabhu, he explains in the Lilamrita that at first Prabhupada said 64 rounds. All my initiated disciples must chant minimum 64 rounds. But they kind of complained. They said, what, Prabhupada, you know, we have to do this. We have this errand to do. Prabhupada said, fine, at least chant 32. And then all the devotees were still kind of hesitating. He says, fine, at least 16 rounds you must chant every day. So Prabhupada's goal was that people would be sufficiently qualified to chant 64, but because we don't have the concentration, the intelligence, or the fixity of mind, therefore he reduced the standard. But in the beginning, there was no deity worship in the first 22nd Avenue. Even in the beginning in San Francisco, in Montreal, Prabhupada had no idea of introducing the deities at first. It was simply engaged in hearing. That was the main process, hearing Prabhupada's lectures and chanting. So what is this? This is Bhagavat Marg. Bhagavat Marg, of the nine limbs of devotional service, the first two are most prominent, hearing and chanting. But then we find the Pancharatrik Marg, which is the next step down. The Archanam is Vandanam, offering of prayers, offering of deity worship, making friends, surrender. These are the most prominent in the Pancharatrik. And so in the beginning, there was no real structure or even rules and regulations. But gradually, as time went by, one day, Malati Mataji, she came to Prabhupada's office and she presented these little statues she'd found in some novelty store in San Francisco. And she said, Prabhupada, look what I found today. And she put this little black figure on Prabhupada's desk. And she says, do you know who this is? What is this? It looks Indian. And Prabhupada said, he immediately offered his obeisances and said, oh, this is very auspicious. You have brought Lord Jagannath to San Francisco. Previous to that, Lord Jagannath had never really appeared in the Western world. He had just been settled there in Jagannath Puri. But Prabhupada considered this Malati Mataji as having been divinely inspired by the Lord, that Lord Jagannath personally wanted to be worshipped there in the West. And so he's the one who gave her inspiration through the Supersoul to manifest there in San Francisco. And so Prabhupada immediately announced, yes, we should have Rath Yatra festival. And so that's when the process of deity worship started in the Western world, which involves celebration of festivals and all the rituals and lifestyles surrounding the deity like that. And then we see that as time wore on in their ISKCON society, in the beginning, devotees were very much living in the temples and had no needs outside of simple temple life, of renunciation, sleeping on the floor, distributing books 8, 10, 12 hours a day, living on a bus and traveling. They were living the lifestyle, more or less, of a full-time preacher. But as time wore on, more and more Prabhupada disciples got married, and the need arose for community, for schools, for all kinds of institutions, and all kinds of buildings and resources and facilities and occupations and farms in order to accommodate more of these desires. Because they moved out of the temple and expanded their activities into protection of the devotees, into economic development, and into arts and crafts. Therefore, one had to shift from the Pancharatrik rules and expand those into the third level I talked about, which is called the Vedic. So the Vedic accommodates beyond the Brahminical lifestyle. It includes the Brahminical, but also adds on to it the Varnas of Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra, like that. Which more or less means that there's a whole ton of more rules to govern the lifestyle of the devotees. Because, to be very frank, living in a temple, it's very simple. You know, you have one rope line, you hang maybe 3 dhotis maximum at a time. But when you live at home and get married, then you need like closets full to fit all your saris and all your suits, and then the children's room and all that. So all the facilities need to grow and expand. And along with those facilities means the rules and regulations, how to properly get married, how to have children, the proper samskars for raising those children, the cutting of the hair ceremony, passing away of the relatives. So many, many more rules and regulations extend beyond just the simple Pancharatrik. And so this is what emerged in our ISKCON society as we matured into a more, a more complete or a more comprehensive society like that. So in this sense, whether you want to live outside and live your life independent of the temple, make your own money and have your own occupation, whether you want to live in the temple or whether you want to live on the bank of the river, there are rules and regulations for the Pancharatrik and the Vedic, which we must follow. And this is what Krishna is emphasizing in this 12th chapter, is connect yourself to me somehow or other. If you're not chanting my name, then at least follow these rules. If you can't follow these rules, then at least follow these rules. But in whatever circumstance, connect yourself to me somehow or other. And this is the meaning of Bhagavad Gita in its final conclusion, Sarva Dharman Parityaja Mamekam Sharanam Braja. He says, give up all varieties of religion. So if one is very immature, one may read this verse and read the first line and say, hey, give up religion? Great. That's what I've always wanted. I never believed in that stuff anyway. But the problem is, in the next verse he says, give up all religion and surrender unto me. So what is the purpose or the point of this instruction? Is that give up all forms of religion which have no connection to me. Give up religion for religion's sake. Give up cheating religion. All the rules that are meant for economic development, all the rules meant for elevation to heavenly planets, for sense gratification, for liberation. He says, forget about following these rules for that purpose. You still follow these rules, but you do it for my pleasure now. And so this is what's coming out in the 12th chapter, is how we can connect no matter what level we're on, follow some of the rules and regulations. So now one may ask, well, what exactly is the process of getting acquainted with these rules and making progress spiritually? And at this point, important tool for analysis is what comes out is to understand what it means intelligence and mind. This is the main point Krishna is making, is the first instruction is engage your internal senses. Of all the senses we have, some are gross, some are external. This means your eyes, ears, nose, mouth, taste, your tongue. Those are external, and then your mind and intelligence are internal. They're called antakarana, like that. So the first thing is, if you can just engage your internal senses, this is the best. But if you can't do that, then engage all your external senses. So therefore, what is the process by which we can actually purify our external senses? And what's coming out here is this Niveshaya in this verse refers to the intelligence. And the Buddhim, of course, is intelligence. And Mana, of course, is mind. So this is a very important principle, and it's called Shravana Manana Nididhyasana. This is the method by which anything is acquired in spiritual advancement or even in all branches of education. If you can remember these three steps or processes, then the entire science of Krishna consciousness is to be understood. So what I'm trying to say is this manana refers to the intelligence and the nididhyasana is the mind. But I'll explain. So the first process of progressing in any branch is shravana, is hearing. In order, like for example, one may tell you something like, don't smoke. Smoking is bad for you. So at this point, the shravana is complete, that the knowledge is there. There might be a statistic on the box that says, causes cancer, it's bad for your unborn children, it'll destroy your lungs. And an intelligent person will contemplate this. This is the next stage, which is called manana. And he'll practice it, and he'll live his life without cigarettes. And then he'll come to nididhyasana, the realization that it's true. That by not smoking, I can have, very clean breath, nice white teeth, and I can live a nice healthy lifestyle. He's realized it. However, you ask most smokers, and you tell them, you shouldn't smoke, it's really bad for you. And they'll say, I know that. If you knew that, then why are you still smoking? Because of attachment. Even though the shravana may be there, the knowledge, it may be theoretically grasped, still it hasn't been realized. The gyan may be there, but the vigyan is not there. So the whole process of devotional service, the process of appreciating something's value, has to come from simply hearing something's glorification. Someone says, rasgullas are really good. But, I'm from Canada. I never heard of a rasgulla. What is it? What is it all about? You don't really know until you taste it. So that practice has to actually be there. And then after sufficient practice, you may become convinced, which I am at this point. So the point is, the shravana has to be followed by actual contemplation. And this contemplation is also called vichar, which means analyzing this knowledge from different points of vision. Somebody tells you that you should chant the holy name. But we don't really have any taste for holy name because we never done it before. But the more you practice, then you eventually come to realize that there's so much nectar in the holy name. But it only comes from the middle process, which is called manana. Or it also corresponds to your sambandha abhideya prayojana from the abhideya process. So in this sense, all our activities have to be performed in knowledge. And this is the point of the niveshaya in this verse. Apply your intelligence in me. So this means contemplation of what we've heard. So in that sense, we have the example of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur gives a story about five monkeys who are sitting in a cage. And the owner of the cage, he contrived a nice little system inside and he's hung some nice juicy ripe bananas from the top of the cage and he put a ladder right underneath the bananas. And then he put the monkeys in the cage and of course the monkeys, they spotted the bananas and they all dashed towards to climb the ladder to grab the bananas. But as soon as the man saw this, he took out his cold water hose and at high pressure he sprayed all the monkeys and the monkeys went flying on the side of the cage. And he kept spraying them and the monkeys learned a good lesson that if we try to climb the ladder, we get all wet. And so as soon as one monkey forgot about this trick, he would go back and he would try to climb it and then instantly get soaked by the hose again. So the monkeys eventually caught on and they realized that one should avoid just accept some other food, be satisfied with whatever else he's given us. These bananas are forbidden. And so one day, the scientist decided to swap one of the monkeys with a new recruit. He stuck a new monkey in the cage. And of course, this monkey didn't know, so he ran up the ladder to go grab it. And at this point, the interesting thing is the man didn't even have to spray this monkey. Why? Because the other monkeys knew. If he tries to climb this ladder, we're all going to get sprayed too. So the other four monkeys, they just went hysterical and they grabbed the monkey and they started beating him and fighting him and dragged him down and threw him on the ground. And so this fifth new monkey, he learned, okay, don't go near the ladder. And so gradually, one after another, the scientists kept swapping one monkey in for a new one. And by this time, there were five fresh monkeys in the cage who didn't dare touch the ladder. Why? Because they had been trained by their previous smart monkeys like that. So even though they had no idea what the reason was for not touching these bananas, still, they would not do it. They were well trained, but it was based without any knowledge. There was no actual basis for their following this rite or this ritual. They just knew that you have to beat up and punch and kick anyone who tries to touch this ladder. So this is more or less an illustration of blind following, of performing an activity without any understanding. And this, unfortunately, led to the downfall of the Vedic Dharma in India. What we find today is that when I was in university, there was like some, you know, cultural diversity clubs where you get to know people of other faiths. And so I would ask, because I was very curious, I was inquiring about religion at the time. Oh, so you're a Protestant. So tell me, what is Protestantism? What makes it different from all the other religions? And they would explain. And I asked the Jewish guy what he thought, and the Buddhist. And everybody had a nice answer explaining their faith. And then I asked the Hindu, there was many Indians at my university, and I said, so what's Hinduism all about? And he says, oh, you know, not much. You just like wave a lamp at this deity and, you know, we chant some mantras. But what's it all for? I mean, you know, there's God and what's it all about? He says, no. You see, it's all about doing the ritual right. If you just get the ritual right, then nothing else matters. There's so many different philosophies. But as long as you know how to chant the mantras with the right meter, and everything will be fine, and you'll merge into everything at the end. And so somehow or other, this wasn't very satisfying to me, and I kind of questioned, well, what's going on in these people's minds that they actually have no real basis? There's the exoteric, external rituals are there, but what about the esoteric meaning behind them? And that's the sad state, is that most people, you may know some, you know, enjoy going to temples and they do their nyasas and they touch this and they spin around and they take the water and they touch the fountain. And I was actually in the back balcony of our temple one time and I saw this one very nice lady. She was very pious. She was visiting, the Krishna and Rasa Leela pastime, diorama. And so she went to take the dust of Krishna on her head. And then comes, Krishna and Arjuna on the chariot, take to the head. Oh, there's Lord Ram and Lakshman, take to the head. And then she came upon the changing bodies exhibit, where one soul is being repeating cycle of birth and death. He's entangled in the samsara. And she goes to everyone and takes their dust on his head like that. There's the man who changes into the bear. We used to have the exhibit here. It was a man who's like sleeping all day, so he becomes a bear. So she took his dust on her head for blessings like that. And so it's a very nice sentiment, is that you're very humble and you want to take some blessings from, you know, great mahants, but there's no real understanding of why we're doing this and who the people are that are involved. And so it's good, it's progressive to have the form right, but manana means contemplation. Just the shravana, if you just hear about this or have a practice or a habit, it doesn't actually produce the realization that we want. In the same way, chanting the holy names, we can do it mechanically, somebody told me to. If I don't do it, my temple commander will get mad at me or my spiritual master will be disappointed in me, so I better just get these rounds over with. This practice of chanting the holy names, it'll still be beneficial because the name is absolute, but it won't have the same kind of power or purifying potency as chanting the holy name with understanding, with real deep devotion and gratitude to the holy name and a very keen understanding of why we're doing it and where we're going. So that will actually yield the realization and not just the simply following out of ritual like that. So the real key at this point is to develop this kind of attachment. In verse 9, Prabhupada is explaining the 12.8 describe the path of attachment, when one is actually attached to the Lord. And then this next one is someone who has no such transcendental love, who's not really attached to the form of the Lord. So to develop this attachment requires this very deep contemplation and this very deep practice. And this is what comes out in the sixth chapter as well, when Arjuna is telling Krishna, well, my mind is crazy. It's harder to control than the wind. And Krishna says, oh, asamshayam mahabaho, mano durnigraham chalam, abhyasena tu kontaya vairagena chagrihyate. He says, no doubt about it, asamshayam, that this mind is very difficult to control, Arjuna, but by proper practice and by proper renunciation, one can actually subdue the mind to the point where we can actually develop this taste, this namaras, like that. And so in this verse, Krishna explains, well, what is the process of practice? What is the process of renunciation? Again, firstly, it's the hearing, the Bhagavat Marg, of very nicely hearing about the Lord and taking his prasadam. So the nice thing about this Bhagavat Marg, which is the hearing and chanting, is that anybody can do it. Prabhupada said that even if you have to give a lecture and there's no one in the temple, you should speak anyway. Preach to the four walls. Because there's also some microbes and germs. Maybe no germs because we took a cold water bath. But there's also some germs in the air who are getting benefited by hearing. Because it's absolute, they're actually getting purified. And anybody can perform in this Bhagavat Marg. In order to chant Hare Krishna, you don't even need to be human. And the story of Shivananda Sen, when he made his pilgrimage from Navadweep to Jagannath Puri, he brought this dog along with him, and it was his pet dog. Wherever they would stop in the night, he would feed the dog prasadam, remnants, and he became very attached to this dog. But one day, the dog went missing. Shivananda Sen freaked out. He told his assistants, oh, we have to go search for him. They sent out a search party, but they couldn't find the dog. And so he was feeling such separation, but they continued along their pilgrimage nonetheless, and they went to Jagannath Puri. And Shivananda Sen, he was still totally depressed. But when he reached Puri and he met Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu sitting there, there was his dog sitting right next to Lord Chaitanya. And Lord Chaitanya was happily eating and joking and feeding his prasad remnants to the dog right there. And the dog was eating up all Lord Chaitanya's remnants. And Shivananda Sen was totally amazed. And he went down and he offered his full dandavats to the dog. He says, you've even received more mercy than I have by tasting Lord Chaitanya's remnants. He won't even give to me. And so he was very happy to be reunited with his dog. But the next day, the dog left its body. And even though Shivananda Sen was feeling such bereavement from this loss, he knew that this dog went back to Godhead. And this dog, it was explained to him that before he left his body, he actually started chanting Hare Krishna. He was barking out the Maha Mantra like that. Lord Chaitanya would tell the dog, bark, tell me the mantra. And he would just chant along with him. So even the dog was chanting Hare Krishna. When Lord Chaitanya went to Jharkhand forest, what did he do? The painting's right there. He got, what is it, the animals. He got all the elephants, the deer, the tigers. They were all chanting in ecstasy. When Lord Ram performed his pastimes, who did he get engaged in service? He engaged, wanaras and bears. They weren't even human, strictly speaking, but still they were engaging in this devotional service. So this is actually to our benefit, or at least to mine, because in order to chant Hare Krishna, you don't even have to be human. Prabhupada says that the Varnashram institution means human life. Unless you're practicing Varnashram nicely, you're actually adhering to these rules, then it's subhuman. It's actually maybe sophisticated, two-legged, royal edition of the animal, he explains. That you may be very polished. You may go to dinner and there's like 3 forks here and 5 knives there and 2 cups and you have to know which order to eat them in. It may be a very refined kind of culture, but it's still animal because it doesn't follow the Vedas. It's mental concoction. It has no real basis in reality. It won't get you anywhere spiritually. So therefore, human life begins when we start following the Vedic culture, when we actually recognize some kind of divine authority like this, and we bring our lives into line with the scriptures. So what Prabhupada did when he went to the West is he realized that I'm having this program here in the temple, I'm giving a lecture, but what were his disciples at the time doing in between kirtan and lecture? They were going to the coffee shop, drinking coffee, eating donuts, they were petting their own dog, then coming into the temple. they weren't exactly strictly following all the pukka rules of Vedic, you know, purity, let's say. So even though, strictly speaking, they weren't on even the human form of life because of all their attachments to illicit sex and intoxication, nonetheless, they were so purified by the process of chanting Hare Krishna that they willingly embraced the process, and they ended up spreading this Bhagavad Dharma and this Pancharatrik Dharma all over the world. Every single yatra in the world practically was started by some American who was never raised in a Vedic family. They never were even practicing real human life, but by the process of purification, by engaging in the fire of bhakti, they actually were able to engage in these other processes, like the Pancharatrik, like the Vedic. The Vedic is actually very demanding of its practitioners because one has to be in the mode of goodness. In order to actually have a proper system of Varnashram, the Vaishyas have to give in charity, the Kshatriyas have to protect, the Brahmanas have to be self-controlled, they have to be very knowledgeable, austere. Even the Shudras have to desire no honor, no respect, and be very respectful of their authorities. So what are all these qualities of respect, of submission, of devotion, of detachment? This is the human level. And the fact is, when Prabhupada went to the West, he didn't find people of this kind of character right off the bat. Even when we chant our Gayatri mantra, it's only given to one who's in the mode of goodness, who is brahminically qualified. Because actually the Gayatri mantra has no real benefit for one who's not fixed in goodness. So in that sense, the Maha Mantra is even more merciful than the Gayatri. Maha Mantra is more merciful than all these Vedic rules and regulations because anybody can do it and it'll take us to the supreme goal. So this is the real ultimate instruction that Prabhupada's giving in verse 12.8 is that along with all your activities, okay, so you have a job. So you have to do all the Vedic ceremonies. That's good. You should do Garbhodhan Samskara. You should actually, you know, get your astrology chart done before you marry this girl. You should make sure that you're the right nature, you're lined up like that. You should perform all these rituals of human life, but never think that these are more important than chanting the holy name. All these activities are a support to help us fix our minds on the holy name. Because when we sit down to chant, the reason we don't have attachment for Krishna, for his beautiful, you know, Shama Sundar Tribhanga Lalita form, is because we have attachment to so many other forms. Like you're thinking of your children, or you're thinking of your wife, or your prospective wife, or your prospective husband, or your grandparents, or your parents, or you're thinking about what this devotee said, or your job, or your money. The mind wanders to so many other sense objects. So this is a problem. And the way to overcome this problem is to actually deal with it. You engage with your children, your parents, your loved ones. You follow the rules. And in the process, you also chant the holy names along the side. Because if your material life is not going smoothly, if you're always fighting with your significant other, if your children have turned into, you know, drug addicts, if, you know, you're not satisfied in any of your relationships at work, if you don't have enough money, then the mind is never peaceful. And a peaceful mind can never focus on the holy name. So therefore, these other rules are given, the waking early, the bathing, because what this will do is actually make our material lives peaceful, prosperous, and actually happy. And when we're peaceful in the material level, when we're actually experiencing bounty in our material lives, and we're following the rules nicely, this will actually bring the mind to the mode of goodness, then this peaceful mind can chant the holy name with pure attachment and with real benefit. But since our material lives aren't going so well, and they never will go perfectly according to our desires, the chanting of the holy name has to go on. And failing this, Prabhupada then gives the next instruction, which is, one should accept the eatables or the remnants of the Lord. Because, as we saw, even Shivananda Sen's dog can eat prasad. Similarly, for us who are so unqualified, prasad is our real saving grace. It says, Ata Shri Krishna Namadi na bhavet grahyam indriyai sevan mukhehi jivado svayameva spuratyadaha. That this holy name, Ata Shri Krishna Namadi, Krishna's holy name, his form, his qualities and pastimes. How can we actually ascertain the real value of this name? the eternal beauty of Krishna's form, the rasa, the amazing taste of his pastimes, it's not by one's mundane senses. It's not by material senses you'll get this. What will actually reveal it? Seva unmuke jiva. Ado. That beginning with the jiva, the tongue, service must be rendered. And through this service, svayameva spuratyadaha. That the automatic manifestation, a revelation of the glories of this holy name will be made apparent to us only through this service attitude. Service, where does it begin? With the tongue. And that's why in 12.8, Prabhupada is saying, firstly, we chant the holy names of the Lord. Secondly, we take the remnants. Because the tongue is such a wild sense, it's the most difficult to control. Prabhupada has given us these amazing diet, or this amazing recommendation and proper medicine for our condition, which is chanting the holy names Hare Krishna and taking prasad. And this has to go alongside of all the other rules and regulations that we'll be discussing in tomorrow's verse and the verse day after tomorrow. So I hope that this was at all useful and that we can always, all of us, come to this very deep appreciation for the practice of manana, which means engaging the intelligence, properly understanding everything in its proper position, and in this way, progressing in our devotional lives, even though we may not have so much qualification, still we have the ultimate goal of this complete attachment, samadhi, fixed concentration on the Lord's holy names. Thank you very much for your kind attention, for your fixed intelligence and mind. Would anybody like to ask any questions or make any comments on today's class? Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.